Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 17th of January. Our guest this hour is a writer for the American Spectator and has written an interesting piece, Creative Destruction in the GOP. Our guest, Lawrence Henry, writes that the GOP is undergoing a process of creative destruction, of complete redefinition. He talks about the mid-Democratic voter, demographic voter in terms of age, about 40 years old, born in 1968, coming of age in 1986 at the end of the Reagan era, and has no sense of the Carter failure, of the transformative nature of Reaganism, and has known nothing but the Reagan recovery. He says that for the GOP has fielded a strong roster of candidates, at least four of them with a real chance to win the nomination. The party hasn't shrugged up somebody like Bob Dole. The nominee hasn't been settled early. No party machine has anointed anyone. And so what could happen here is that the campaign is going to stay interesting for a long time. And if we're lucky, we'll emerge from it with a newly defined and newly invigorated Republican Party. If we're lucky, the country will nominate some image monger. If we're unlucky, the country will nominate some image monger with nothing real to say. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Lawrence, and our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050 for you to join our conversation. Hi, Lawrence. Thanks so much for being with us.
Kathleen, you can call me Larry if you would.
All right, Larry. I'll call you Larry. Hi, Larry. what do you think it means for the party? Is it good for the party or bad for the party, or does it just make it interesting that we have all these different winners, that nobody's coalesced around somebody yet?
Well, I think it must be what Rudy Giuliani was counting on. I don't know that any candidate could be quite that prescient as to anticipate different winners for every primary leading up to Super Tuesday. But it's just electoral politics. It's the way things go. There are a lot of strong candidates in the Republican field, and there are niches that need to be appealed to, and each of them appeals to a certain niche.
Right. Are you surprised that there have been three different winners in the three so far races?
No.
You're not?
Not at all.
Because?
Well, John McCain has traditionally done well in New Hampshire. In a state like Iowa, run on a caucus system where highly motivated people like evangelical Christians are likely to turn out in significant numbers. The appeal of someone like Mike Huckabee is obvious. Romney is a favorite son of Michigan, and he spoke directly to what people have called the one state depression in Michigan with the beating down of the auto industry, and promised them what they wanted to hear. So I don't think there's any surprise in those three wins.
And what do you make of Giuliani? He really is banking on Florida for his win here. Has he let too many months go by and too many primaries go by with doing very little that he's kind of out of the race, or can he experience a resurgence?
No, think back 3 weeks ago, nobody was talking about McCain, and all of a sudden he pops to the top and wins New Hampshire.
Right.
I wrote an article called It's Giuliani Time in the fall of 06, saying that I thought that Rudy Giuliani was the best positioned Republican candidate to win, even among moral conservatives. I argued that the effect of a president on the issues that moral conservatives care about is comparatively slight. Most of those issues get decided in the courts.
Mm-hmm.
So such a candidate would, in terms of what he could really do, you'd be looking at just the appointing of judges. And a law and order judge is also likely to be conservatively minded judge on moral issues. So I asked in conclusion what evangelicals should say, how much can Giuliani hurt us? And the honest answer is not much.
Mm-hmm.
And that as a very strong candidate, he may be the guy who can win. I still do think so. So I know it's a bit of brinksmanship that he's playing with, and in fact, apparently he has suspended salaries for his campaign workers for a month leading into Florida, which makes you worry about it a little bit. But I think he can still come through.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about McCain. Today's, I'm sure you've seen New York Times, has a big story about the politics being played in South Carolina, some fairly dirty politics. Vietnam vets against McCain sending out a flyer, accusing him of selling out fellow POWs to save himself, some phone calls about his divorce from his first wife while he was a prisoner of war. What is this antagonism against McCain on the part of some people in the Republican Party? Who are those people and what don't they like about him?
Oh, gosh, you can go through a long list. I can't speak to those objections from the vets. I just finished reading McCain's autobiography from several years ago, Faith of My Fathers.
Mm-hmm.
And he does acknowledge that early in his imprisonment, he told his North Vietnamese captors some things that he should not have told them. But the other POWs comforted him and offered him a great deal of support. And thereafter, McCain told them a whole bunch of nonsense about his service and about American military capabilities. And his ultimate decision was that the North Vietnamese didn't know truth from fiction anyway in what they were hearing. And I read nothing in the book that would tend to substantiate what you've just told me some veterans are accusing him of. But let us make a negative list for John McCain.
All right.
He opposed President Bush's tax cuts when they were initially proposed. He made common cause with Ted Kennedy to try to ram through a comprehensive immigration reform bill, which the Republican base and, frankly, a great deal of the country saw as blanket amnesty for illegal aliens, and was determined to run it through Congress without much consultation at all. When the Republican Party was on the verge of invoking what was called the nuclear option to secure the confirmation of federal judicial appointments with the simple majority by a Senate rule change, it was McCain and Kennedy who, and I believe, can't pinpoint all of the people. Lindsey Graham, I know, was in there. But he initiated a compromise called the Gang of 14 to preserve the Senate's capability of blocking judicial appointments with filibusters. This was, in fact, a major defeat for Republican policy objectives. In short, John McCain has proven himself willing to betray the Republican Party for his own personal glory over and over and over again, and the Republican faithful will not forget that.
Hmm. On the other hand, we could say that this is an era where the American people are calling for bipartisanship, reaching across the aisle, trying to come up with something that maybe some in the Republican Party, some in the Democratic Party would not be in favor of, but we need to work together now, and that McCain may be the best of all the Republicans at doing just that and be able to win independents and really stand a fairly good chance in a national election.
Well, the numbers in Michigan would contradict that, and the numbers in New Hampshire would contradict that. In fact, he didn't win among Republicans. So no matter how many independents you pull over, if you can't win your own party, you're not going to win.
Mm-hmm. What about this issue of immigration? You mentioned it, Larry. When you look at what people are concerned about, immigration is up higher when you pull Republicans than Democrats, but it's still not, you know, one or two. It's there, but it's not huge. You would disagree with that, probably.
I disagree with that, Kathleen.
Yeah.
I think that it kind of depends on how you ask the question, but certainly it's a hot topic on talk radio, and there are people on both sides of the aisle who are extremely exasperated at the preponderance of illegal immigrants in the country and the fact that our current crop of illegals seems not to be interested in assimilating.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a big issue. I think it's an issue of major importance. And it's one issue on which the Washington elites are very much out of touch with common opinion.
Who is in touch with common opinion among those candidates for the Republicans?
Well, Mike Huckabee has the style.
He has a great style, doesn't he?
He does.
And this guy's got the gift of gab.
Unfortunately, he's willing to say anything and has reversed his field on a number of issues. Fred Thompson, probably in terms of the substance of what he has to say, now that he's finally woken up and started saying something, is perhaps closest to the broad Republican coalition.
Mm-hmm. You have quite a line about Thompson in your piece that we're referencing today, that he would apparently rather blog from home than speak on the stump or shake hands in diners. The talk about him when he first entered the race is that he has a tendency to be lazy, and I guess that that sentence would indicate that you believe that might be the case. He just woke up recently.
Well, I wrote this piece, and thankfully my editor printed it before the South Carolina debate. Thompson quite definitely woke up in the South Carolina debate. Mm-hmm. He was the first guy who actually spouted something other than a bunch of platitudes in that debate. And I was glad to see him do it. I don't know. Fred Thompson still may come through in South Carolina. It would seem to me that one or the other, Thompson or Huckabee, is likely to appeal to the voters the most. And word from South Carolina in the last two or three days is that Mr. Thompson has been out there shaking hands, getting seen, making speeches, and doing the whole retail political number. So perhaps I just bought into a bit of popular spin about him. I certainly got one very angry letter from one very angry Fredhead telling me all about Fred Thompson at great detail.
Well, wouldn't that be something if Thompson wins South Carolina?
It would be.
Would that be good for the Republicans or not?
I think so.
You do?
I would like to see it. As a matter of fact, I'm with Mark Levin. I would like to see everything go right down to the convention, and I'd like to see the whole thing hashed out in a delegate fight at the convention.
That would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Yes. First time in a long, long time.
Yeah. I was listening to the news this morning, and they were talking, and I've forgotten this, that the Republican that you have to win South Carolina. There's never been a nominee who didn't win South Carolina.
Yes, until the next time that a nominee wins who doesn't win South Carolina.
What do you think of Romney, Larry?
Well, I've always thought that he's professionally the most impressive of all the Republican candidates. Very, very capable, very knowledgeable, has good ideas, tremendous management expertise, tremendous energy, and the ability to separate the wheat from the chaff, make good appointments, do the difficult thing. I admire him a lot. He tends to come across kind of as a cold fish, a kind of a technocrat. And if he can warm up his image, I think he should do very well. The mainstream press certainly has been ignoring the fact that Romney is our true front runner right now in terms of delegates and wins. So let's just see what happens. Apparently, he's not going to bother contesting South Carolina, but he'll pick up a win in Nevada that'll actually yield more delegates.
Mm-hmm. But you also, in your piece, talk about the fact that he put mandated health insurance in a place like Massachusetts, and then mm-hmm. you ask, what's going on here?
I do wonder at that. I was at a financial conference last year when one of the really smart people that you tend to encounter there said to me what you had said earlier, that the American people are hungry for a consensus, a kind of a middle ground.
Yeah.
And in replying to him, I said, well, where's the middle ground on health care? Do we agree that there's a problem, first of all? And second, what can you propose that somebody on one side or another wouldn't condemn as a radical solution?
Mm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's Romney had his reasons for doing what he did, and of course he had to deal with a legislature that was Democratic and had a veto-proof majority. So he had to find something that would get through. And the average cost of a health insurance policy has dropped significantly in Massachusetts since the passage of that act. I just question its philosophical underpinnings. Why should the government be able to make you buy something?
Mm-hmm. You talk, Larry, about the turning the solid South from Democratic to Republican, mm-hmm. that Reagan was able to do that and put together this coalition. Do you fear that in this election, because there's dissatisfaction with the direction of the country, that could change, that the Democrats could get a hold on the South once again?
No, I don't think that's terribly likely. Of course, there'll be individual races where the Democrats do just fine, and there are a lot of Republicans retiring, 23 from Congress at, I think, the last count that I read. So there's certainly opportunity for Democrats. In fact, the transformation of the Solid South began with Nixon. It began, of course, in some ways over the civil rights issue, but it's an oversimplification to say that people in the South wanted to preserve Jim Crow or segregation. It was a great deal more than that. The old Democratic Party used to be very much a Jim Crow and segregationist sort of party. Remember people like Russell Long.
Sure.
The transformation to Republicanism, I think, was a reflection of as much a desire to institute some good government habits as anything else. You know, around the country there have been, from time to time, half a dozen, maybe eight states that have been single-party corrupt fiefdoms that were just awful in terms of the intersection of crime and politics. And a number of those used to be in the South, Louisiana, Arkansas, Mississippi. We've got a few up here in Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island. There's Delaware. There's Maryland. But those are all Democratic states. And the gradual transformation of the South from a Democratic to Republican may have had as much to do with wanting to throw the rascals out as anything else.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Larry Henry is our guest, writer for The American Spectator, and he has a recent piece, Creative Destruction in the GOP. If you'd like to read the piece while we're talking, well, you could do that. It's www.spectator.org, www.spectator.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Oh, did I give you the number? 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. If you'd like to send us an email, that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program, we'll have our open line for the month of January, and you can suggest topics, ideas, authors, political conversations, if you can think of one that we haven't already had. So we'll open up the lines for you after 10 o'clock today. Larry Henry is our guest now, and we're looking at the Republicans and welcoming your phone calls, 800-486-8655. Tom from Wausau is our first caller, Larry. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. Oh, you got a real bad buzz on your phone, so.
I do, huh?
Yes, you do.
Is it a little better now?
A little bit. Good. Just go ahead, Tom.
Okay. My question is there's a rumor if the parties, if the right people aren't elected, that the mayor from New York would jump in as an independent. What would that do to each party, and which party do you think it would favor?
You're asking me, Tom?
He is, Larry.
Well, I don't know. If Mayor Bloomberg enters the race, I think it's mainly a function of his ego. I don't think he has any real political constituency nationwide. And he's got the personality of a lizard, so I can't see that he'd do all that well in a national race. It is interesting to speculate on who he might take votes from. It depends on how he positions himself. If he positions himself as a big government solution instituter of kind of a if he positions himself as an alternate Hillary, then he'll take votes from Democrats. If he positions himself as an alternate Romney, he'll take votes from Republicans. It kind of depends on what he does.
Mm-hmm. Got a lot of money, though, doesn't he, Larry?
Well, yes.
So he could do a lot of television ads and radio.
Yes,
ads.
He could. Mm-hmm. I hope he doesn't answer. I think it would be foolish and very much counterproductive for both parties.
Thanks, Tom, for the call. Jim is next from Salt Lake City. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Hey, I attended the GOP state convention here in Utah, and it's quite interesting to me because it's a predominantly one-party state, and there is so much anger in the GOP, especially toward this one incumbent in Provo. And what was so interesting in this bitter convention fight, the people in my row said, whatever we do, we got to stand by our man. Whoever gets nominated, we got to, you know, keep the seat, blah, blah, blah. And what was so interesting was John McCain spoke, and they wanted to leave. And I said, wait a minute, he might be our standard bearer. And they said, hey, if he gets nominated, we're staying home. Hmm. We're not going to vote for him. So I wonder if there might be a ripple effect, unintended, that these candidates who are in tough districts, because of all this anger in the GOP because of immigration and other issues, there actually might be more of a backslide in the House that would give the Democrats a greater majority unintentionally.
Oh, gosh. Boy, that is real inside politics stuff, Jim. And I'm glad for the report from your convention. It's very interesting. That's just too hard to predict. I don't know. Certainly, whoever runs on the top of the ticket is going to have an effect on down. Some people are naturals that way. Some people, you know, Reagan had a wonderful effect on down the ticket, and George W. Bush not so much so. So who knows about coattails? It's very hard.
Mm-hmm. But can you really imagine, if John McCain were the nominee, can you imagine people sitting home and not voting?
Absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely. I think what Jim saw and heard at his convention is very common.
Hmm.
There are people who feel as negative about McCain as they do about Hillary.
Hmm. What do you mean when you say in your piece, Larry, that we're in a new world now and both parties have to find a new definition? What is that new world, and how would you like the Republicans to define themselves?
Well, it's more or less a function of just the way politics works. No idea ever succeeds in politics without having a popular champion of some sort. And we had a certain roster of popular champions of ideas in the 1980s. We had a certain roster of popular champions of ideas around 1960. Remember, the Republicans got pretty well redefined after losing to Kennedy. Goldwater came along, lost big, and then we kind of went back to the establishment side and nominated Richard Nixon in 68, who won, and won big, an election after that. So this redefinition is not anything new. But what's really interesting to me is that if on the one side you have a deck of cards with the names of issues on them, and the issues are abortion, Iraq, stem cells, economy, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, you have a deck of cards with candidates' names on them. Those, which, as you deal out the hand, which, who's going to be the champion of what?
Right.
And what's going to prevail? We
mm-hmm.
don't know.
Mm-hmm.
There's this great shuffle going on, and we don't yet know who's going to be an effective champion and what issues he will effectively champion.
Mm-hmm. So can you win if you are – it was sort of hard to figure this all out, right? Is there anybody who brings together those stand on moral issues that Thompson and probably Huckabee are running on, somebody who you have faith that they've got a good business sense like Romney so that he could deal with an upcoming probable recession, that you've got John McCain who – probably people believe could take on terrorism better than anybody else. Do you have to have somebody who's got the whole thing, who's got the whole package?
Probably not. Go to an election with the qualities you have, to paraphrase Donald Rumsfeld, and you don't necessarily have everything.
Mm-hmm.
What the question you just posed is the question that is being posed at large in the primaries right now.
Right. Is there somebody who you really wish would have run, Larry?
Who's not there right now?
Right.
I'm a real bad early candidate picker. My early candidate a couple of elections ago was Phil Graham, and an election after that was John Ashcroft. So I'm no good at that at all.
Thanks, Jim, very much for your call. One line open if you'd like to join our conversation, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in the Milwaukee area. Our guest, Larry Henry, it says that the GOP is undergoing a process of creative destruction, of complete redefinition, and that, that's not necessarily a bad thing, that during this campaign season, if they're lucky, they'll emerge from it with a newly defined and newly invigorated Republican Party. If unlucky, the country will nominate some image monger with nothing real to say. Larry is a writer for The American Spectator. And we go back to phone calls. Tim is next from Milwaukee. Hello, Tim.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. I'm sorry, I know you by Larry.
Henry. Mr. Henry.
Okay.
Larry Henry.
you mentioned earlier you don't think government should force people to buy anything with the example of Massachusetts and health insurance.
As a general principle, yes, I'd
say
that's
correct. A general principle, I agree with that also. I'm wondering what your thoughts are then on states that like Illinois where they force people to buy car insurance, or next year we are all going to be forced to buy converters for our televisions?
Well, you aren't forced to drive.
That's true.
And you aren't forced to watch TV.
I agree with the principle that government shouldn't force us to buy anything, but wouldn't you say that, these past several years where the legislation has been made to switch to the television, that they're in essence forcing us, and we do, we don't have to watch TV, but I think if you told American people, well, just get rid of your TVs, you're not forced to buy anything, there's a sort of indirect, we're not responsible for it, but we're going to change the laws anyway, is sort of the impression that I'm getting. You're not forced to watch TV, but that's a little disingenuous.
Well, what's disingenuous is that the government does regulate things, and that is unlikely to go away. We all gripe about the security measures imposed on us when we get on an airplane, for example, but in fact, we don't have to fly. The difference in being forced to buy health insurance is that in Massachusetts, you are forced to buy health insurance whether or not you ever even leave the house.
Thanks, Tim, very much for your call. Let's go to Mike next from Nina. Hi, Mike.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
In my mind, the last good Republican president was Eisenhower, and with any integrity and caring about any working people. And his farewell address says it all, warning about the military industrial. But my question is, what influence do you think Rupert Murdoch with his Fox shows and the Wall Street Journal and GE with their defense industry and NBC will have on picking the next corporate bootlicker?
On picking the next corporate bootlicker.
That's what he said.
I don't think the influence is any more palpable than the influence of the New York Times, which tends to set the daily news agenda for most people in the media.
Thanks very much for the call. There's kind of a nostalgia for Eisenhower this year, isn't there? I guess the buttons for Ike have been selling well at various conventions.
Of course, he was a military hero.
Right.
He proved himself. Let's not forget that Eisenhower marked a transformation in the Republican Party, too. Mr. Republican, pre-Eisenhower, was Bob Taft, who was an isolationist. And to elect a proven internationalist like Eisenhower rubbed a great many people in the Republican Party the wrong way.
Mm-hmm. Bill from Deerfield, hi.
Good morning. I wonder, Larry, what you think about the the anemic outturning of Republican voters in the caucuses and primaries. People, you know, Republicans or different Republicans are winning, but they're not winning many people.
Well, it takes a lot of effort to turn out for a caucus, of course. And I don't think the turnout in New Hampshire was anemic, was it? That was just about what you'd expect. So comparing caucus turnout to a primary turnout is not quite appropriate.
But the Michigan primary turnout wasn't great.
That was 0.2 million less than what they expected. But of course, on the Democratic side, party had forbidden people to—they'd unassigned the delegates because Michigan had tried to jump the line in primary assignments. So there are a lot of things operating here to account for lower turnout. And in any case, primaries don't grab people the way general elections do.
Do you think—and yet, when you look at— press coverage of all of this, there seems to be, I don't know if they're just making something up here, but there does seem to be more motivation, more excitement, and more people voting on the Democratic side this time. What do you make of that, Larry?
I don't know that that's necessarily true. I'd have to make a number-by-number comparison, but gosh, to me, the game's a lot more interesting on the Republican side. What's interesting on the Democratic side is that I mentioned in the column that the Democrats kind of set their rules in stone in 1972 with the McGovern rules, requiring proportional representation based on race, sex, and things like that at their convention among their delegates. And this year on the Democratic side, it is the apotheosis of a class, race, and gender race, I think that they've dug themselves a hole, and the only candidate who appears to be above the business of hole digging is Mr. Obama.
Thanks, Bill, very much for your call. Let's go to Jim from Antigo. Hi, Jim. A couple lines are open, 800-486-8655. Hi, Jim.
Yeah. Thank you. Two questions. Should the Republican Party do anything to reduce income inequality in the country? And do you think that when Reagan opened his election campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, that had anything to do with whites in the South finally voting for the party of Lincoln?
Answer to the first question is no. Income inequality is generally addressed in the political sphere as though it's some static thing. The rich are always rich, the poor are always poor. In fact, income in the United States is very, very malleable and dynamic. The people in the top 20% are going to move around into another category 5 years hence, and the people in the bottom 20% are going to move up and out in the same period. To have government engineering who ought to make what, no, I think that's entirely inappropriate. As for Reagan kicking off a campaign in Mississippi, I'm sure he had some political debts to pay and some obligations to discharge and thought that was a good place to make a speech. I don't think there was much more to it than that.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Our number 800-486-8655, 227-2050. How does the Republican Party deal with what seems to be day after day of pretty bad economic news here, Larry? There's a lot of concern about a recession. We got problems with homes, new homes, and subprime mortgages, and there are a lot of people who just are not doing very well in this economy. So how do the Republicans address that, and who best addresses that?
Well, I thought it interesting in the South Carolina debate that the very first question the journalists raised was, would you employ an economic stimulus package to avoid a recession?
Mm-hmm.
To me, that was the wrong group of candidates to ask that, because the orthodox Republican position is no. I wouldn't do so. The quickest way to let a recession work out is to let it work out. That's the conflict between Hoover and Coolidge. We've dealt with that for a long time. But as far as there being a lot of people who are not doing well, the interesting thing statistically is that most people say they themselves are doing well, but they have a suspicion that their neighbors are not. So I wonder exactly how bad shape we really are in. I was at a Christmas party over the holidays and ran into a mortgage to a real estate agent that I know, and she said 97% of the people in the country are paying their mortgages. So, yes, there's something going on in the lending arena. It mostly has to do with the repackaging of mortgages into mortgage-backed securities and large financial institutions having made large and inappropriate bets on those securities. And now, of course, those institutions like Citibank the other day are getting bailed out by infusions of capital from places like Singapore and Malaysia and Dubai. So this is just the dynamics of the economy, and it's working itself out the way things do.
But there are certain – we had this guy on yesterday who used to write for the Chicago Tribune, who spent – the book is really good, and he spent a long time traveling 11,000 miles all over the Midwest to look at what's happened to the economy in the Midwest. And the news that he found was not good news, that things are not working themselves out very well, that with globalization in the world, a lot of the jobs that used to be done, you know, say, here in Milwaukee, heavy manufacturing, family-supporting jobs are not here anymore, and that they're – and what's happened to the farm industry and what's happened to the automobile industry in Detroit and elsewhere, too, that – that we're hard hit, that people have lost those jobs, that they're not making nearly as much money, that sometimes they're moving in with their parents, that they're working at Walmart, et cetera, that there's been a profound change in the economy in this part of the country, and that somebody needs a plan to do something about it because people are hurting.
Well, I don't know. Certainly on an emotional level, all candidates on either side of the aisle are going to be addressing just that. Because that is certainly the popular perception. I don't necessarily think that's the wise thing to do. We are likely to work our way out of this a lot quicker without government interference.
We welcome more phone calls. Larry Henry is our guest, and he's a writer for the American Spectator, has written a piece that is the stirring point for our conversation this hour, The Creative Destruction in the GOP, which you can find at spectator.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Open line, the second hour of our program. You can suggest great authors, great ideas, great topics, great guests. That's something we do once a month, and so it's coming up the second hour of our show. Larry Henry is with us now, and we're talking about the Republican Party. 800-486-8655 is the number. Dave from Ellison Bay is next. Hi, Dave.
Well, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I did get a chance to read your guest's article briefly, and I'd like to use Ron Paul as sort of a context for asking a couple of questions. Ron Paul, to me anyway, the strength of his campaign is doing what I understand Ronald Reagan did when he first ran for president, especially in 1979 and 80, and that is to call for the country or for the federal government back to the constraints of the Constitution, and then subsequently abandoned that, and the government grew in spite of his pledge to make government less of a problem than more of a problem. And to me, clearly, and I'm not a political scientist, I'm an observer, a very interested observer, both parties largely have abandoned the restraints or the protection that the Constitution historically, at least, has provided to keep the federal government minding its own business, so to speak. Ron Paul, to me, is the only candidate that's really calling for that that return to constitutional government. And in spite of his positions on the war, maybe because of it, I don't know. But his even in your guest's article, Ron Paul is only mentioned in the context of the fact that he's raising a lot of money.
Larry.
Well, I've got a Ron Paul supporter in my very home. My wife likes him. And And I absolutely agree with you that the principles that he espouses are principles that I wish more Republican candidates espoused and more of them talked about and more of them paid real attention to, rather than automatically looking for a government solution to something. I would rather we remember that the role of a public official is to solve public problems and to leave private problems to themselves. Why Mr. Paul has not caught fire any more than among people who want to give him money, I just don't know. Maybe he's a little too old. Maybe he's a little too eccentric in his mannerisms. But I do absolutely agree with you on the ideas, and I wish that more of those were placed front and center in the Republican debate.
Where is he getting all his money? He has a phenomenal ability to raise money, Larry.
I honestly don't know, given the limits on individual contributions. But boy, does he turn them out when he wants to raise bucks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he sure does. Thanks very much for the call. Here's an email, Stephen from Milwaukee. Larry, how can you honestly say the shift of the South to the Republican camp had anything to do with good government? Their famous Southern strategy, focusing on using race as a wedge issue, they used race overtly and covertly in destructive ways for decades. Even the former chair of the party admitted that and apologized here in Milwaukee at an NAACP convention.
Oh, I think that's the popular perception, but I think politics is more complicated than that. I really do.
Let's go next to Jeff from Grand Rapids. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Larry, I had a question. You know, I was a history and political science major, and I'm kind of going through all the Republican candidates. And really, Fred Thompson is the one that, for me, epitomizes everything that Reagan has. And my concern is that because he doesn't have enough money, he's not getting the talk shows and he's not getting his message out. And I'm a little concerned that the people aren't feeling empowered because if you don't have enough money, you can't get your message out today.
Yeah, it's rough. Money is definitely political speech. I think that such spending ought to be fully protected and allowed. But Fred Thompson aimed, after all, in the beginning at trying to communicate in a new way, kind of to do an end around of the conventional establishment. I was very gratified to read his many contributions to right-wing journals. I was very gratified to see that he had taken over Paul Harvey's slot on his daily newscast. I thought this all spoke very well for Mr. Thompson's savvy as to how to get across to the people, and I'm surprised it didn't work better.
I think that this race, as we're seeing, requires a whole lot of stamina. I think that's one of his problems, Larry, is that he's not moving fast enough. He's not working hard enough.
Well, I don't know whether that's true or not. He's a big man with a big voice who speaks with a Southern accent, and someone like that is perceived to be slow, but someone like that can hand you your hat, too, before you realize what's going on.
Yeah, but I mean, just in terms of from what I've been reading about him, is that he's not working the diners, that he's not going up and down the towns, these small towns or large towns.
He's doing it in South Carolina now.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see what happens on Saturday. I would be very gratified to see him get a good result on Saturday. I'd like to see him stay in the race.
Thanks, Jeff, for your call. We go to Mary from Madison next. Hi, Mary.
Hi, I'm enjoying the show very much. We have good friends of various ages that live in Upper Michigan whose lives have been turned inside out by the problems with the auto industries there. For better or worse, like most of us, they didn't look very far ahead. And as somebody said the other day, the labor force up there tends to consist of people with either four-year high school degrees or their high school dropouts, who have very good records as employees, but essentially have been taught to do one thing on an assembly line. And even though everybody wants to glide over this quickly because it's so awkward, I wondered how the speaker felt about Romney holding essentially the bone over the head of the dogs a few days ago and saying he would bring the auto industry back. Anybody that looks down the road can't imagine, looking at the world situation today, how the auto industry is ever going to come about again in that part of the country where there's really nothing else up there.
All right. Your phone is not terrific, Mary. Good question. Larry?
Well, Mary, it's it is a tough situation. It's a situation that many people in many states have faced over the history of the United States. There are abandoned mill towns all over New England, where I live, that were formerly devoted to making locomotives or doing textiles or things like that, or making shoes, and those are gone now, too, leaving behind a workforce with high school educations or worse that only know how to do one thing. Let's remember that the Employment Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, that's a long time ago, that's ERISA, the act that controls the governing of pensions in the United States, finished up with a section, a title, that was devoted to educating people whose jobs will never exist again. It's part of dynamic change in the United States that such things go on. You yourself, in describing the people in Michigan, said that they made bad bets in depending on a single source of employment. And yes, it's a bad bet. Okay, now can the automobile industry be turned around? It is probably a physical impossibility to come up with a fuel that entirely replaces oil anytime soon. The imposition of an artificial standard for performance, i.e. the CAFE standards, is more likely to result in lightweight, dangerous cars than it is to result in any real savings in terms of energy consumption. So what can the automobile makers be incentivized to do that would make them vital once again? Mr. Romney has talked about investing a whole lot in research and development for alternate fuels and technologies, and that's probably just about the only way to go. I said earlier in the show that Romney's win in Michigan had to do with him saying what people wanted to hear, and he did that, and it remains to be seen whether that one state depression can be solved with such a program and whether such a program is worthwhile pursuing for the nation as a whole. We just don't know. It would take a heck of a good manager to do it, and if anybody can do it, Romney can, I think.
Thanks for the call. Gary is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, good morning. I would like to hear the guest's opinion about the RJC and how much influence they will have or are having.
What's the RJC?
The Republican Jewish Coalition. It's headed, from what I understand, by a guy named Brooks, and they have some very deep pockets backing them, namely Sheldon Adelson. And how much influence they have in selecting a candidate and in formulating positions and policy?
Well, given that I've never heard of them either,
I
can't vouch for their effectiveness at all.
Yeah.
Well, I'm amazed you haven't heard of the RJC.
Nope, never came up.
Check it out.
It's can't be huge because nobody's heard of it. Send us info if you want, Gary. And let's go to Bjorn from Rice Lake. Hi. About a minute left.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
I'm just calling to see what Larry's thoughts are. There was a mention of the writer from the Chicago Tribune who had done the research on Midwest jobs being lost.
Mm-hmm.
But his opinion on how people's buying habits sometimes have created their own job loss because they are they're always searching for something cheaper and cheaper, and so they start to buy products that are coming from overseas, and eventually it's going to have a turnabout and cause their jobs to possibly leave the country, even though it's maybe not the same type of product. But
okay. Larry?
Well, that's true. All part of the process of a creative economy.
Mm-hmm. You want to predict what's going to happen in South Carolina?
Well, I guess it's looking like a Huckabee win, and it may be the last one. I think Mr. Thompson's showing may be unexpectedly good and may give him some real life.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you, for too, Kathleen. It's been wonderful.
Larry Henry, our guest. If you'd like to go to his website, you can get a copy of the article that we've been talking about, Creative Destruction in the GOP, and the website is spectator.org, spectator.org. Lawrence Henry is a writer for the American Spectator, and he talks about the problems and the strengths of all of the candidates and why it is that there is no clear front runner, that everybody hasn't coalesced, that we have all these different interest groups, why they haven't coalesced around one candidate at this point. So that's that. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we'll return with our open line. So get those phone calls in right now. John Treader will be on the phones getting your suggestions for programs you'd like to have on the air between 9 and 11. So join us. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.